Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios in our super secret underground bunker, transmitting across the internet. I guess we're not really transmitting today, but this is episode 94 of Registry Matters. Happy, well, now it's Sunday morning, Larry. We're messing up the schedule week after week right now.
We are, but good morning.
Good morning. We're in our super secret bunker, and like I said, it's Sunday, and then I've got plans. I'm headed up to Atlanta, and so what were you just saying about our patrons are going to like have conniption fits?
Well, they're going to be in a state of withdrawal.
I won't be able to edit this until sometime tomorrow morning. It'll go out, I don't know, probably by 10 tomorrow morning.
Well, I have some great stories to tell you about my experience of arriving yesterday.
Please indulge us about... Wait, first, my first question, and the listeners are going to be waiting by... Did you bring your shower kit?
Of course I did.
Okay, just making sure. Didn't want anybody to feel left out.
You never know when you might need it.
So tell us a story about picking up a rental car.
Well, apparently... as many years as I've been traveling, I did not understand that a car reservation does not assure one of a car. And it always has up until now, but I arrived at Atlanta's famous Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport yesterday and walked up to the rental counter at Advantage Rent-A-Car. And they said that, "Do you have a reservation?" I said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "We don't have any cars." And I said, "Well, you don't?" "Well, it said confirmed reservation." "Yep, but they all gone." And I said, "Well, do you have any idea when I would be able to get a car?" "A couple hours." So I thought, literally, that means that the next car in will be mine. And I figured cars, a major station like that, can be coming in continuously. I've been where cars are being turned in at Hartsfield, and they're just one right after another. I thought, well, it won't be too long. So after waiting an hour and a half, I go down and say, "Well, how are we coming on cars?" "He's going to be at least 2 hours." I said, "Well, that's kind of what you told me almost 2 hours ago." I said, "The truth of the matter is," I said, how are you letting people know that cars are available? You're not giving numbers or anything?" "No, no." He said, "We see you out there." I said, "So I need to stay around here and wait?" He said, "Yeah, if you want the next car, just hang out here so we can see you." I said, "Well, that doesn't seem like a very good system." So finally, I decided to give it up. That I went from counter to counter, from agency to agency, and no cars were available. And I decided to give it up. And so I had to install Uber on my phone, which meant I had to delete an app because I didn't have enough space. And I put Uber back on and got out of the airport and got down to the secret bunker. And then this morning I called customer service, the famous 800 number, because they don't publish local station numbers at Vantage. And I tried to call. I hate to make the 50-mile navigation back to the airport and them not have cars. And customer service informed me that they don't have direct contact with the rental stations and that they can see the reservation and that they hope that there'll be a car there. And they don't know why I didn't get a car yesterday. I said, "Well, I don't know either." I said, "But I can tell you why they told me I didn't get a car is that they didn't have any cars." And I asked them what a reservation meant. And they said, "Well, it means that you should have a car, but we don't know what happened." And we went round and round. I said, "So basically customer service, really, there's nothing you can do. You can't confirm there's availability this morning. You can't do anything other than say, good luck, make your trip to the airport. Basically, that's it. So if you're dealing with Advantage Rent-A-Car, just know that customer service cannot communicate with the rental stations."
Can we back up? What kind of phone do you have that you have to delete everything off to install a single app?
Well, I guess it's called the ZTE, but it was when I went from the flip top to a more advanced phone. I asked them to give me something basic that would be easy to operate, and this was what they gave me at my request. They said, "Well, you can start with this." So apparently it has 8 gigabytes, and it's running 7.5 right now. So if you have another app to put, you have to decide. And the funny thing is, all the apps I have, none of them are deletable except for one. So I have to switch. I can have one additional app other than the ones that are on the phone itself that are not deletable.
So I'm dying over here.
I can choose which app I want to have.
All right. So you get to pick from one of the over 1 million apps that are in the App Store. You get to pick one.
Well, just out of curiosity, if, say you had a robust phone, how many apps would you be able to put on a phone that had that didn't have these limitations?
With the phone that I just got, I mean, I don't want to say unlimited, but I have like 60 gigs of music. Like my whole music library is on the phone, and I am only using about 30% of it, and I have every app that I could care to have, but I don't install junk apps. I don't install games. I don't install just worthless things. Everything is like for productivity, but I still am only using about 20 or 30% of the phone's storage.
Well, how does 8 gigabytes compare to what a normal person's phone would be?
I think that I have 250 gigs of storage on my phone. So eight is.
So you have slightly more.
A tad, not a whole lot. Right. I'm using 23%. Yeah, I have 256 gigs.
But see, at the time, I didn't realize all that when they told me that this will do the basic things you need to do.
Correct.
It did. It served me quite well. It gives me navigation. It gives me access to email, internet. It does everything I need to do, except I can't have my banking apps and different things I want to have on the phone.
Absolutely.
So I think it's time to increase my capacity.
I think so. We can talk about that. Maybe I can make some suggestions. All right. Let's roll on with the show. So I hope you get your car situation fixed up. That's a funny story. Will, our famous Will listener, Patreon supporter, he has asked a question, and we are going to have a guest speaker answer the question for us. You ready to go?
Well, what is the question?
I will let Will ask the question.
Good evening. This is Will from Tennessee, and I have a question. When appellate judges or justices hear a challenge to a law, do they have the discretion to subject the law to a lower level of scrutiny than would be appropriate? Example, the Minnesota civil commitment was upheld by application of the rational basis test. I mean, wouldn't one's freedom being taken indefinitely be worthy of the highest level of scrutiny possible, which is strict scrutiny? I was just wondering, how much discretion do the judges have in these situations? Thank you. And for all you people who think the registry is such a great idea, you're such friendly young people.
All right, so here's the response.
A staple of our constitutional jurisprudence, though, is what we sometimes refer to as tiered review, the notion that the default position is that actions of legislatures are valid and unless they're not rationally related to some legitimate interest. But under some circumstances, we'll treat the work product of legislatures as being presumptively invalid. A racial classification, for example, we apply strict scrutiny and we make the government prove a very strong justification. Some people say that's breaking down, that tiered review, you guys really don't do what you say you do.
I'm not even familiar with the terminology. Tiered review? Why is it called tiered review?
Oh, I was just
makes you weep?
No. T-I-E-R, the upper tier of the opera house. It might make you weep, too. I mean, that's entirely possible. But what I meant to convey was the various standards of review that you folks use to apply rational basis scrutiny, strict scrutiny, intermediate scrutiny.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that's what we're talking about. So is that breaking down?
We pretty much made it up.
Yes, that's true. It's not the Constitution. Are you going to keep making it up?
I have never been a fan of it, and partly it's breaking down because predictably it's expanded. So you have strict scrutiny, intermediate scrutiny. Should there be semi-intermediate scrutiny and whatnot? I mean, it's a shell game of loading the. It's a thumb on the scale, and I don't think there ought to be a thumb on the scale.
So how do we go about then? And Professor Mitch Berman, I believe he's at the University of Virginia, or at least his article was published in Virginia's Law Review, made the argument that there are constitutional operative provisions, and then there are decisional rules that implement them. We might, for example, say cruel and unusual punishments are prohibited, but we have to come up with some rules to figure out which ones. Now, originalism is one rule. But if we abandon the various levels of judicial scrutiny, rational basis, strict, semi-intermediate, whatever, what do we put in their place?
Why do you need anything in their place? Why can't you ask whether this piece of legislation is unconstitutional? Why? Yeah, you have to come up with a reason. And if the only reason is that it treats taxpayers differently, some pay more money than others, the answer is that's not a good enough reason. You're permitted to discriminate in taxing on the basis of wealth. I'm not sure the system would break down without these thumbs on the scale. I mean, you would end up with the same need to show justification for those provisions that run head on against provisions of the Constitution, such as discrimination on the basis of race. Of course, anything that overtly discriminates on the basis of race, I mean, if you want to call it strict scrutiny, you can call it that. But the simple fact is that the mere fact that it does that it makes you think right at the outset that it's no good.
So unless a provision were to either conflict with the plain text of the Constitution or the original public meaning of the provisions of the Constitution, we should assume its validity and leave it to the representative branches.
Unless there is reason to believe that the provision of the Constitution was directed against this, which, you know, it was not. Nobody thought it was directed against sex discrimination. That's a modern invention. There are those who think it shouldn't exist, and of course it shouldn't exist. But you don't need the Constitution. You don't have to distort the Constitution to achieve that result.
All right. I need you to dumb it down for us, please.
Sure. Well, what the justice was saying is that clearly the levels of scrutiny, which very few people can explain, and I'm not feeling that I'm qualified to explain them fully either, are invented. And anything that's invented, of course, to answer Will's question, yes, they have some discretion in how they assign they select their level of scrutiny they're going to give. But what the justice is saying is that practically everything is constitutional in his book. Because of the extreme deference he would afford the legislative process, and unless it runs head on against the Constitution. And he made the example about taxing. There's no thing. The Constitution says you can't discriminate against people. There's specific prohibitions against discrimination, but there's we like to expand the Constitution to include things that we think that the founders ought to have thought about that weren't thought about at the time. And from his perspective, that everything would receive any legislative enactment would receive extreme deference, except for when it was blatantly and obviously in violation of the Constitution or the Bill of Rights. That's what I heard him say in that answer.
And by the where you can't discriminate is what I guess is called a protected class. So that would be race and then sex and the myriad of other things. But so you can discriminate based on, like, your wealth. You can discriminate based on taxes. So everybody doesn't, it wouldn't be fair to say it's unconstitutional to tax people at different rates. Same as then to give people different levels of supervision based on a conviction, because that's not protected.
Well, that's what I end up having this discussion with people all the time. They'll tell me something's discrimination. I'll say, you're right, it is. And they'll say, I want to go to court. And I said, good luck. You're not protected. There's no law that says you can't discriminate. There's nothing we can make such laws, but there's no law that says you can't do a lot of forms of discrimination. There are laws that say you cannot do these specific forms of discrimination. And when you're in the apartment rental business, if you're in the housing business, which I once was, you couldn't discriminate, and it was very clearly defined what you could. But I could say, I simply just don't like a jerk like you that comes in and you threw your litter in my parking lot and you're dressed completely like a bum and you stink. I could do that, and that would not be discrimination because it would not have been any of the protected classes that I'm aware of. There's no protected class of stinking.
I have a feeling that all of these things, like, I'm dressed like a bum and I certainly didn't shower today and I did drop a bunch of trash in your parking lot. Are you talking about me?
Yes, but but you could do that lawfully. Now, I am not recommending that people do that, but in terms of the Constitution doesn't protect everybody from everything. That was not a document. It was designed with the intent of being this vast protector against everything. It was designed to protect against certain things that the government might reasonably be anticipated to do, and to give people certain rights. And then there's the belief by some that it evolves over time to reflect the values of a modern society. And then there's the more conservative wing of the courts who believe that, no, it doesn't evolve. It means today exactly what it meant a long time ago, and no more, no less.
You know, that the attorney that we had guested on a couple months ago, I continue to hear him say things like that way of thinking, the conservative, like, never changing philosophy. I think he says it's a garbage philosophy. I want to say that that's what he has said, but I could have that off slightly. He just doesn't think there's any evidence to support that it is a, the way that he described it is, you look at all the judicial precedents that has happened leading up to now, and that is how you know that the ideals have evolved.
Well, even Scalia, I don't know if we're going to play that clip today. I get we've had so many, I don't have it confused. But Scalia himself, I think if we've not played the clip about sound trucks, we'll play it at some point. But when faced with the question of whether sound trucks were unconstitutional or should enjoy protected status, he said, well, of course, the founders didn't have sound trucks. So you would have to take a look at the trajectory of the Constitution over time. He himself admits that's a form of evolution, because since there weren't sound trucks, he said you would have to take a look at the trajectory over time and what would the founders have wanted in terms of protecting people who had sound trucks. And he believed that they would want to most expansively as possible protect the exchange of ideas. So sound trucks probably would have been legal within reason. So he acknowledges that there is some evolution. But he believes his fundamental core belief was that you look at what everything meant at the time it was written, and you give it those as you're interpreting, you ascribe nothing more than what they would have, how they would have interpreted those words at the time.
You have just used the word about seven times, sound truck. What is a sound truck?
It's like when you have one of the speaker and announcing.
Okay. So you have a car and you have like a megaphone on the top of it. And
yeah,
you're like,
yeah.
Hey, attend this public service announcement at the city council meeting tonight. Right.
Yeah. Well, okay. There was a case where Scalia talked about whether the ordinance prohibiting sound trucks was constitutional. And I don't know if it's on today's agenda, but I have got that picked out somewhere where we're going to. And he talks about the trajectory over time. What would the trajectory have been?
It seems like that would give someone an unfair advantage of spreading their message.
It would.
So it should totally be banned.
So, well, this intermediate scrutiny, which is less than the strict scrutiny, the brief research I did, this was something that the Supreme Court invented in the 70s, like in 76. And then the rational basis is the lowest level of scrutiny, which means, and this one really confuses people, they confuse rational basis with rational result. And the result of a statutory enactment doesn't have to be rational. Only the basis for the enactment has to be rational. And they said, well, the sex offender registry doesn't work. But the rational basis for wanting to protect children, that is rational, even though the outcome is not a rational result, because it doesn't do that. The court doesn't get to go back and say, okay, we've had this on the books for 5 years, let's take a look at the result. That's not their job to do that. That's the elected branch's job to do that. So they often confuse rational result. And they said, well, the result isn't rational. There's no discernible drop in sexual offenses. That's not the legal standard, folks.
Just if the idea behind it, I mean, you can, if we had everyone driving around at 20 miles an hour, there probably wouldn't be any fatal car crashes. That's a rational idea, but is it good public policy, et cetera?
That is correct. You have no right to drive at any particular speed. And those long time podcast listeners have heard me talk about that, the 50 mile an hour speed limit we had in the 70s as a result of the energy crisis. We learned over time that the negatives outweighed the benefits of the, as cars got more efficient, you didn't recognize any fuel savings, and that the accident rate went up, fatigue, productivity dropped. We learned all those things, and then we changed the 55 mile per hour speed limit, and we raised it back up. But that there's no constitutional issue there, because the rational basis was that we were going to save energy and have safer streets. Whether it did that or not wasn't relevant. But had they said certain classes of people could drive greater than 55, for example, if they'd have said men can drive 70, women can drive 55, then you would have had an equal protection issue, because you would have had a constitutional claim.
Interesting, interesting. And then, so can we then just tie that back over to Will's question about taking people's liberty and the strictest of scrutinies?
Well, I agree with Will that but unfortunately the registration statutes generally have not been reviewed. Well, they've only been afforded rational basis review, and sometimes the courts have found they didn't even pass the rational basis review. I think in Illinois there was a case or one of those that our Wisconsin Illinois team, the Weinberg Nicholas team worked on. It was ultimately their victory was, I think, snatched away from them. But the court said it didn't even survive the rational basis review. But I agree with Will. When a registration scheme is taking away fundamental liberties, that should enjoy the strictest of scrutiny, a review by the courts.
But so, I mean, he's talking about, I think, well, he was talking about the Michigan case, correct? He referring to lifetime supervision in Tennessee?
I'm not sure the context, but if it's lifetime supervision, there again, you're greatly inhibited a person's liberty.
Yeah, no doubt.
When they're under lifetime supervision. Now, the registry doesn't impose, people say, well, it's the same as probation. Well, no, it isn't the same as probation. It has a lot of debilitating factors, but when you're under registration, as far as I know, you don't take drug tests.
Right.
So as far as I know, with exception of those categories of sexually violent predator, like in Pennsylvania, they require people to get treatment as a SVP, or as one of the registry tiers as SVP. But as far as I know, you don't have to go to counseling. It's a condition of registration.
I think the big deal would be, you know, obviously going and getting booked, but then if your state imposes it, the different living and work restrictions. I mean, those are massive, massive factors.
Absolutely. Well, the advance notice for travel. That's a debilitation where people, a normal citizen just gets in their car and hooks up the RV and they start journeying across the United States. Well, some states require an advance notification of out-of-state travel more than 3, 5, or 7 days. That's a debilitating condition, similar to probation. In that regard, it's similar to probation. In the state of Alabama, as a condition of registration, you have to obtain a travel permit.
So no supervision, but you have to obtain some kind of permit.
That's correct, and I believe it's for all out of state travel, not just out. And that was stricken. They had, if you had a city police in your jurisdiction in Alabama before the courts intervened, you had to get the travel permit filed with your city and with the county. But they eliminated it down to just to the county, but. A registered sex offender in Alabama has to get a permit to travel. Now, in terms of probation, the permit has greater attachments to it, as far as I understand, compared to Alabama. You don't have to give a reason for the travel. Like if you're going to travel when you're under probation, parole, or any type of correctional supervision, there's more expansive requirements of giving of the reason, purpose for the travel. As far as I know, in Alabama, you don't have to tell them why are you traveling. You just have to tell them, I'm going to be in Utah for the next whatever number of days. And they give you a piece of paper that says, we understand you're going to be in Utah for these days. But the registry is very, very debilitating depending on what state, what jurisdiction you're in. It can be very similar to probation, but like I said, it's not identical. When people say it's identical, as far as I know, like I say, there's no drug test I can think of that you're required to take to be on the registry. And as far as I know, well, I take that back. I was about to say who you can live with. You have to get permission when you're under supervision in my state to have a relationship with someone. Well, in essence, you almost have to do that in some states, because if they have children, although it doesn't say you can't have the relationship with the parent, it says you can't have minors in your home. So in essence, it interferes with relationships as well.
Certainly. Certainly. All right. Well, I hope that answers your question, Will. And if not, I'm sure we will hear from you again.
I think we will.
We will from Will. All right. The first article that we have comes from Fox 13 Now. This is Salt Lake City, Utah. Conviction aside, Utah Supreme Court says sex offender must register. As I understand it, that this individual, Mr. Holste, or just Holst, he moved into Utah from Idaho, Iowa, one of those states up there, and he had his conviction set aside, if I remember right, and he's still required to register, and he's angry.
Well, I don't understand what his anger is. The law, the law is perfectly clear.
All right, next article. I think I mentioned the definition of set aside. Are there more than one definitions of set aside?
There is, and what confuses people when they hear the term set aside, the first thing that comes to most people's mind would be that the evidence was not sufficient and an appellate court set aside the conviction on legal grounds. And the person was innocent, or at least not guilty. Well, in this case, that's not what happened. In this case, he received an outcome that's similar to what we call a conditional discharge. The average person thinks when they hear the term set aside that the conviction was set aside for lack of evidence. But there are other set aside, which would be like if a person completes the requirements of the court. So a plea would be taken saying, I did do the crime. The evidence is sufficient. And the court withholds judgment. They call it deferred adjudication, a number of different things. And this is what happened in this individual's case. He in fact had stipulated to the evidence that he had committed the sex offense in Idaho. And then he was required, the key to this really is he was required to register in Idaho even with that outcome. And the Utah court took a look at it and they didn't use the same terminology, but they had the same situation where a conviction is in abeyance. You can plea in abeyance. And in Utah, that still triggers a registration obligation. So the Utah Supreme Court decided that for all practical purposes, he did have a sex offense conviction for registration purposes, even though the conviction had been set aside. So it was an outcome I would have expected, because an attorney of a friend of mine had done a similar case from Florida, where the person had their conviction set aside, and he comes to New Mexico and says, well, I've got a set-aside. And they said, well, that's nice. You still have to register because you had to register in Florida. That didn't alleviate your Florida registration obligation. And he says, well, under New Mexico, if I'd have gotten a conditional discharge, which they withhold adjudication, and you complete the period of probation and comply with all the terms, then you don't have a conviction. Well, we specifically in our statute, we exempt that. And he said, so therefore, had I done this plea in New Mexico, I would not have had to register. And they said, well, the thing of the matter is you didn't do it in New Mexico, you did it in Florida. And the guy was told he did have a registration obligation because Florida required him to register. They didn't give him that benefit. And New Mexico said, under the full faith and credit clause, we're not going to give you a benefit that Florida did not provide you. So therefore, you have to register. So had he come to me, I would have told him that the case law from other states is not favorable to you, although it's not compelling, it's only persuasive. But I would have told him, I would bet that the Utah Supreme Court is going to look to their neighboring state of New Mexico. They're going to look at that state Supreme Court decision, and they're going to come to a very similar outcome as what New Mexico did with the case about 10 years ago. That's what I would have told him. And of course, then he would have gone down and hired a more optimistic lawyer. And he'd have said that Larry is always pessimistic. And that's the reason why we don't win anything at NARSL, because people like him is always so down in the dumps and giving people the worst of news. And they'd have paid a whole bunch of money to get the outcome that I would have reasonably predicted.
And you agree with the decision though, right?
I do not agree with it, but I can see on a legal analysis how you could come to that decision. I wish that it had been different, but it is a very well thought out analysis, because if if they had come to a different outcome, then all the people would come flooding from states where they, even though they had a set aside or a deferred adjudication, they had to register, they would start flooding to the state where they didn't have to register, and they would say, gee, I'm here, I don't have to register, and no state would want an influx of people from other states. So I can see from a public policy perspective why that they did what they did.
Okay. Should we move over to whatever this Molly Jane's law from in Texas?
Sure.
All right. What? Go ahead.
Molly Jane, pretty college student. It's amazing how they always get the laws named after them.
Of course. So this is Fox4News.com. Molly Jane's law creates a statewide database to track repeat sex offenders in Texas. Super short article, not really a whole lot of meat that we can go into. But the law says this will enable law enforcement. Wait, I want to back up on one thing. It requires, yes, it says under this new law, Texas law enforcement must enter information into an FBI database for every sex offense they investigate. That sounds like that's a lot of extra work for them to potentially have dead ends and so forth. Anyway, that was the information that I wanted to get out of that.
I thought they pretty much already do that, maybe not into the FBI database, but I thought that there was a database of investigations. That's what I thought police agencies already do. That's how they try to figure out if they have a serial offender of any type. So this article really didn't make complete. I mean, I think it's probably something that makes people feel good because the student is pretty and attractive. And this is an honor of her, and it's a way to provide recognition but I thought they already did that. Maybe somebody who's in police business or former police officers can correct me, but I thought this was already done.
On the inverse of that, you know, it says that Texas law enforcement must enter. Does that mean Louisiana isn't required to enter it? And I mean, that would be like the first thing that I would ask about that.
Well, I guess Texas is only able to control what Texas law enforcement can do, but I thought as a matter of just general practice that databases were that shared. I thought that's how, I mean, people don't respect the borders of states, there are many people who commit criminal acts that go across state lines, and I thought they already did that.
Yeah, I see where you're going there. I was just wondering if the FBI has a system for the states to do it, but Texas is requiring their law enforcement to do it. That tells me that not all states do it.
Well, it doesn't tell me that. It tells me that Texas may already be doing that, and all other states are maybe doing this. And this tells me that possibly this is a feel-good piece of legislation.
And of course, there is Texas Voices there. I don't know what their stance was, but I'm assuming then that we weren't at the table representing our interests to say that this is some stupid shenanigans.
Well, you would never say that when a dead victim, you would never come say that. You might say it in closed meetings that this is something that's already being done. Because as far as I say, I thought this was already being done. Criminals work across state lines,
of course,
have been for a long time, and sharing information across through databases so that you can identify. I thought that was already being done.
Yeah, I guess that's what you could say. The Homeland Security stuff is where they were supposed to share information across the CIA and NSA and FBI and all that stuff for terrorist acts, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. Well, then we're going to go to deseret.com. This has got to be desert because it's not dessert, even though it could be deserterate. Anyway, after years in prison, two Utahans found innocent of separate sex abuse charges. We covered one of those last week with the guy that was ordered like the $350,000. But here's another one with another individual who was serving more than 14 years for sexual assault that happened while he was hospitalized in a different part of town. Larry, I can't ever wrap my head around the idea that you could have evidence, like with all the hospital staff and documentation, that says that you are at position X and somehow you're convicted of being in place Y while you're in a hospital bed. I can't wrap my head around how we get there.
Well, it's when you're dealing with child victims, they're afforded latitude as witnesses to not have dates specifically right. You got a 9, 10, 11, 12-year-old testifying. as you remember, when you were 9, 10, or 12 years old, how you related to time. You related to time because you were counting down the days to a special event. Is Christmas coming? Is it my birthday? And so a child witness is afforded great latitude in being wrong more than an adult is. Of course, the victim's advocates would have everybody be afforded the same standard that no detail has to be right. But as long as they say it happened is all that matters. But I can understand in the case of it being a child victim where the jury would have cut them some slack. I don't agree with that, but I understand it's the reality of the situation that that's what happens. And so I suspect that's what happened in this case, because it wasn't his own kids who accused him, if I got that right. I did a sloppy preparation for this today. How dare you? Well, you only gave me 10 minutes.
That wasn't enough time? I thought 10 would be enough.
No, actually, I took about an hour, but it looks like that it looks like this was his kids, right?
For sexual assault that happened, I'm looking.
But it was kids, even it said.
Correct. Well, the other one was definitely his kids. They do cover this the other guy in the story where it was his two sons that accused him.
This one says Wickham held down a 16-year-old girl while his friend raped her before taking his turn.
So I don't think that's his kid, so that's a third party.
Now, a 16-year-old should be held to a fairly high standard of reliability in terms of being accurate. We don't think of a 16-year-old as challenged with date and time. So I have a hard time explaining how a 16-year-old, other than the fact that if it comes out of an alleged victim's mouth, it has to be true.
Sure. And, well, we don't have any evidence that victims lie or make mistakes.
Well, not according to the advocates for them. They don't lie or they don't make mistakes. And you'd remember something like that. And if you don't automatically assume the person they said did it is guilty, there's something wrong with you.
Do you see any sort of angle that the newspapers are taking to just at least put some sort of, to put the victim's advocates back in their little box to some degree? I mean, this isn't supporting their cause.
I don't see that. I don't see the victim's advocates being held to account for any of their misguided beliefs and the things they advocate for. It's fantastic that these people are getting some compensation, and he professes his faith in the system, and it actually did work for him after 14 years. But there are a whole lot of people who never will be.
Yeah, of course.
And in cases where it does work, they rarely get compensation, and he at least getting a little bit of money.
Hey, he's getting $600,000, and the other guy got $350,000 for 7 years. So they're giving out something of $50,000 a year for these false accusations, false imprisonments.
Well, I'll go on record of making this prediction that if there were to be an acceleration of these exonerations, that the next wave of advocacy would be say we're paying out too much money because 600,000 doesn't amount to much when you compare it to a state government. But if you actually started paying out hundreds of thousands to a plethora of people to where it was statistically measurable, I suspect that we're going to have to revisit that because this is a line item in the budget. If you were paying out hundreds of these a year.
But what should you do when you have, that sounds like it then drives right into a constitutional claim. You've had your liberties removed and the government was wrong. The government should then compensate for their failure.
Where's that in the Constitution?
The taking away your liberty part is the...
But the compensation, that's not in the Constitution.
So you just say, sorry, my bad, and good luck?
You had due process of law. The Constitution guarantees you that your liberty will not be taken without due process. He had his due process. So the system is not held liable. These are state enactments, and Utah deserves commitment for, and I think Texas and some other states have where they have it in their statutory scheme. But you have no constitutional right to compensation because your liberty has been taken away because you received due process when your liberty was taken away. And as Justice Scalia has said over and over again, we can deprive you of life, liberty, and property with due process of law. You can execute an innocent person as long as they've had due process.
Certainly, I'm struggling on the angle of, and now I've lost my train of thought, but that you have that due process. Oh, so like where's we talk about here that you have to set an incredibly high bar to take away somebody's liberty. And in these cases, these people are with not, doesn't feel to me like there was enough evidence to do it, but they got convicted. So yes, they had their due process, the jury, their peers, or they took a plea, whatever. It then doesn't stand up under scrutiny later, and they have to backpedal.
Well, I don't know if there's a question in there somewhere, but
it feels wrong.
It is, of course, it's wrong.
And not that the government should be flawless and, you know, never wrong, but the standard should be ridiculously high when you're going to do this. This isn't they're taking $5 out of your piggy bank. This is taking away. Then down the line, so this guy is of an older age and he hasn't paid enough money to Social Security. What is he then supposed to do when he hits the age that he would be eligible? He hasn't paid in enough money, so he doesn't draw anything. What does he do then?
Well, those are all great questions. And I would say that you should reach out to the victim's advocates, the people who work so hard to make it easier to convict people. And I would say that you need to have these discussions with them and find out what their position is on why they think it should be so easy to convict people.
I don't like your answers. All right, we're going to move on then, since I don't like your answers. We're going to change the subject.
Well, I have to commend the Utah Attorney General's office. They did not fight this particular with this guy named Wickham. They didn't fight that, which in most cases they do fight tooth and nail. So we're giving credit to the Utah legislature for having a compensation plan where people are entitled to compensation, and we're giving credit to the Utah Office of the Attorney General for not fighting tooth and nail to preserve the conviction. That is a rarity. They usually fight when you're convicted to save their conviction. It's the rarest of prosecutors who can say, actually, I think we got this wrong.
Yeah, no doubt. I do want to ask Ashley that question at some point, since she was a prosecutor, of what is the mindset of being in a position where you go, I can never be wrong, and we will never revisit these old cases. And that just bothers me that they can never go back and admit they were wrong and compensate or something for a terrible, you know, you didn't spend a year in jail, which is a long time also, but these people are spending half a decade, you know, decade and a half in prison, and all of the lost wages, time with family, just the liberty. And it's disturbing, terribly disturbing.
Well, I won't speak for Ashley, but I can tell you what the mindset is. The mindset is that we're in the business of prosecuting and running cases through the system. And when we've provided people due process and they've appealed and appealed and appealed and their appeals were denied, at some point we need finality. I mean, do you want people to be able to litigate their convictions to the end of time?
Unless you get a jury to convict, like to get that finality, like you should be able to defend, you know, a tennis match could run forever and you just joust back and forth forever. Why can't you have a court case go back and forth forever?
Well,
I guess the defendant's going to run out of money.
Well, but also their attitude is that now there are dishonest prosecutors that are happy to have a conviction.
Yeah.
But in their mind, it's already been adjudicated over and over again, and the evidence was overwhelming. And so in their mind, they're protecting what they think they legitimately won. They proved the person beyond a reasonable doubt to a jury of their peers they committed the crime, and they don't want to hear your sob story.
Still feels like it's just a numbers game, that they're just trying to run as many things through and get what sticks. They don't care about the actual consequences. That's how it feels, and I'm sure I am over generalizing what the prosecution is doing.
Well, they don't care about the consequences. They're not spending a lot of time agonizing over the fact that you're in prison.
Right. So then it is just a numbers game. Hey, we have to bring all of these cases because they've broken a law and we're trying to get convictions. It doesn't matter about the justice.
Well, in their mind, justice. See, everybody wants to say justice. In their mind, him serving that 20-year sentence that was imposed on him, that was justice for the 16-year-old that got held down and raped. That was justice. The only problem was he didn't do it.
Right. And so they're wrong. Roll the clock back to the 14 years ago when that prosecutor was doing the prosecuting. They were wrong. They didn't have the evidence to convict this individual of that crime. So
they did have the evidence. They convicted him.
But obviously that was wrong.
It was, in hindsight, it was wrong. But okay, we're going round and round.
I know we are.
The Constitution doesn't guarantee you a perfect, flawless trial. The word is a fair trial. He received a fair trial, not a perfect trial. Humans cannot invent anything that's perfect.
Me.
He received a fair trial. He received a unanimous jury verdict, and I know that because there was only two states and only one now since Louisiana, by voters' rejection of non-unanimous jurors for jury verdicts. There's only the state of Oregon left. So he was convicted by a jury unanimously. There was evidence to support it, but the evidence turned out to be not credible as the jury. It wasn't as credible as what the jury had afforded it in waiting. That's the flawless. The flawed human beings who are told that you have to convict the person beyond if there's not reasonable doubt, and then they're given a definition of what reasonable doubt is, and they didn't have reasonable doubt, therefore they returned a conviction. The prosecutor felt that they had won the case, and it was fair and square, and he was guilty. They were wrong, but that's what the prosecutor felt. What would make us think that everything about our system is going to be perfect, that mistakes are not going to be made? What would make us think that we could design such a system that would have 12 people looking at evidence while they're texting on their telephones and thinking about who they're going to get together with on Friday night, and worried about their kid at school that they got a text saying that the kid was sick, and all these different distractions that are going on in their life? What would make you think that you could ever assemble 12 people who would be totally impartial and who would be able to look at evidence and come up with the right decision? No such system can be devised. Of course people are going to get convicted that are not guilty.
I completely understand and agree. And that would be why you would set the bar even higher before you take away someone's liberty.
And that's why I'm encouraging us to talk to the victims' advocates who want the bar to be continually lowered. I'm agreeing with you.
Yeah, I know.
The bar should be enormously high. I've said this over and over again. When we're going to put people in a cage, it is supposed to be very hard to put people in cages. We're not supposed to automatically believe anything that's said. We are supposed to confront them. That's why we have a confrontation clause in the Constitution that says that the person shall have the right to confront their accusers in open court. That is how the system is designed. It is the victim side who is advocating the abolition of those things. It's not the defense side. We're caught in this where public opinion is massively against us, and we're just making excuses for people who are accused of bad acts, and we should just simply walk into the court, look at the indictment, look at the client, and say, plead guilty, because they're going to convict you anyway. You don't have any right to any confrontation. You don't have any right to any presumptions. And let's just dispense with all this formality. Just go ahead and put your name on the line and say you're guilty. That's what we're supposed to do, according to the victims' advocates.
All right, before we end up down every rabbit hole, let's move on. This is a decision from the Court of Appeals of the State of Oregon. And I think we can sum it up. What constitutes being in residence, Larry? This is a homeless guy, and I think, as I understand it, that he was put back in prison because he would bounce around from place to place to place to place, and his handlers didn't like that he was bouncing around from place to place, and so they locked him back up for living behind this gas station, or then he would spend a night in jail here, and he didn't register those addresses.
That is what I took out of it. It was a long decision, and I skim read it. It looks like it's 23 pages, and I won't have any notes on it unfortunately for this one. But that's what I took from this decision: is that the appellate court decided that he did not break the law because they found insufficient evidence, which is a rarity. for appellate when you're reviewing something for sufficiency of the evidence. The standard is so low on that level of review because if I could try to explain it as best way I can. All the inferences are resolved in favor of the state, and if any fact finder, be it jury or judge, could have found there was enough evidence to convict that person, then the conviction stands. And they overturned this one on sufficiency of the evidence, which is a very tough hurdle because you have to look at it and say no reasonable fact finder could return a guilty verdict. Well, they just on his conviction, they decided that no reasonable fact finder could have convicted him because under the law, everything that in terms of what constituted residence, the jailhouse wasn't. Very few people go. When you think about places you've established a residence, you might establish a residence at a school dormitory. You might establish a residence at a hotel if you're going to be a long-term resident. But when's the last time you can think of anybody who's established a residence at the jail?
I can see turning in the post office mail forwarding card to cell block A, room 12 or whatever.
So they determined that his in and out of jail did not constitute a change of residence. Very few people make the choice to go to jail. So he wasn't voluntarily making that change. And presumably, if they put you in jail, they generally know that you're there, right? Presumably.
I would assume when they're doing head count, they're looking for 20 people. And, how do we have 21? What do we do?
So he's staying at the Chevron station. That really, he put down that as a location. But I can tell you where this is going to end, what all the chatter is over with. What this is going to necessitate, which is the same thing which Georgia dealt with about 10 years ago in the state of case of Georgia with Santos. I think it was Santos versus Georgia when it got to the Georgia Supreme Court. But the Georgia Supreme Court said, we don't have a provision for how a homeless person is supposed to comply. And there's other states that have had this rise to their state Supreme Court. And the Georgia Supreme Court said, so for purposes of being able to provide an address, if you do not have one, you cannot provide one. So therefore, you can't be convicted of doing something that's impossible for you to do. Okay. So therefore, that part of the Georgia registry was unconstitutional. So what the Georgia legislature did is they came back and said, a sex offender who's homeless has to report it, I think, every 7 days or every 10 days. And they have to describe where they have been for the preceding 7 to 10 days. They have to give them that information. So they can do a retrospective investigation looking backwards to say, was he at this gas station? Was he under this bridge? Now, of course, I don't know how you would figure out if they were under the bridge or not. If you go in and say, I was under the bridge down by the Yellow River for the last 7 days, how would they determine that you were there? What would they do? Go look for some DNA or something to figure out?
Stool samples.
I guess they could do that, couldn't they?
Just drop poo off everywhere you go so that you can mark your territory.
So this would be where this is ultimately going to end. If the state appeals the appellate courts, if they file a petition for cert with the Oregon Supreme Court, and if cert's granted, and if the Oregon Supreme Court agrees, then this will ultimately be resolved by the legislature. They will clean up their act, and they will put in the 10-day requirement, which I hate, and I hate it with a passion, that they require a homeless person to come in every 7 to 10 days. If you're homeless, you generally don't have transportation. You don't have a lot of mobility. If you live in an urbanized area, you might have access to public transportation, assuming you can afford a bus pass or whatever it is they use for using public transportation these days. In Atlanta, I guess it'd be a MARTA card. Assuming that you can do that, assuming you can navigate to the registry officials' offices and describe where you've been. So what putting this 10-day requirement does, what it does is it actually does just the opposite of what the intent is. It makes it so that a person has to report to law enforcement. Theoretically, you could sleep under the same bridge for 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, 100 days. And my view is you should not have to go in and report to the registry officials unless you change your location. But according to my good friends in Arkansas, they said it was the greatest thing that ever happened when they put this in their law, because they said judges were sending people to prison merely because they didn't have an address. I said, well, the judges didn't have to do that. They could have easily just said the Arkansas law is unconstitutional. And being that a person cannot comply with that component, they don't have an address, they cannot give an address. Well, what this does here is a person has even more barriers trying to report in to comply, and the chances are they're going to miss that 7 days. Something's going to happen with a homeless person that they're trying to deal with in their life that's going to make them unable to make it to the registry office every 7 days. And then they're going to have a clear-cut violation, because then they're going to say, well, gee, the law says you are a person, right? Yes. It does say you have to report in every 7 days because you're homeless, right? Yes, you didn't come in. This is the 8th day. You're 1 minute past your 7 days and you're not here. And then it opens up for more prosecutions. Folks out there, this is not a solution. This creates new problems. You folks in Arkansas that pat yourself on the back for having that, all you did was made it more possible easily to put sex offenders in prison for not being able to comply. So you can be very proud of yourselves.
Outstanding.
Well, one of the Arkansas advocates told me how proud they were of that legislation. I said, well, I'd be disgusted if I were you. I would not be proud of it at all. I would be, because all you've done is made it easier to put people in jail.
Unintended consequences, I guess.
So that's where this is headed. There's going to be a law to require them to report in weekly.
Let's move on over to law.com and the New York Law Journal. Here is a article titled, Jeffrey Epstein Accusers Handed a Major Loss in Suit Over Government Plea Deal. And the guy's dead, and I know that they're going to go after the estate and all this. But so this litigation has brought national attention to the Crime Victims Rights Act and the importance of victims in the criminal justice system, U.S. District Judge Kenneth Mara wrote. I bet you right off the bat you have an opinion on the importance of the victims in the criminal justice system. I bet you have an opinion about that right off the bat.
Well, I did not open this opinion, so I haven't read it, but I read the story and I agree with Judge Mara. The you're trying to use the vehicle for what it's not intended to do, and there's, it's kind of like HIPAA. The Health Insurance Portability and whatever it is Act.
Yep.
There's no right of recovery under HIPAA of damages that I've been able to identify. Clearly, according to a judicial opinion, the crimes victim, the CVRA, was violated by the prosecutor who was formerly the Labor Secretary, I believe, for President
Trump.
That was violated, but that doesn't give you a private cause of action. And this is the judge saying, well, yes, that there was a violation, but you don't have a private cause of action under this particular vehicle. They're still going to go after other causes of action. These people are not going to stop. This estate is going to be bled for everything by it. Like in my state, they're going to try to forfeit the attorney general's making noise about trying to forfeit the Epstein Ranch that's in Stanley. So these people are not going to go away. They'll just simply come back using a different vehicle, but they're not going to stop. They'll stop when the estate's broke.
The first correction, it's Alexander Acosta. I think Jim Acosta is the CNN reporter
yes,
that gets in
yes.
trouble all the time, but this
yes,
is the attorney.
Alex Acosta.
Right. All right. I bet this gets all the legal junkies all worked up, because this one is so high profile and it's creating interesting legal theory and challenging different avenues, just like you were bringing up the various legal, the vehicles that people can use to try and get at things.
Well, they didn't succeed on this one, but they will go back and try again.
Very well. All right. We have a couple articles. They are covering the same thing. One of them is much shorter than the other one, because of course it comes from the appeal. So that makes it more like a book. This is from the Montgomery Advisor. Men charged as teens sue to challenge Alabama sex offender law, saying that putting people that are minors on the registry is unconstitutional. Of course, Larry, first off, do you support the registry at all? I just want to reiterate that, because we keep having this problem of people thinking that what you're saying, you support these different various things.
So I told the story to several people the preceding week about my little snarky, I don't support these things. I'm doing this in response to listener comments and reactions because they misconstrue something I say that they translate that into support. And when I'm answering a question, hopefully the Scalia clips are helping. Scalia says, I don't take a stand on abortion one way or the other. I don't take a stand on the death penalty. I'm just taking a stand on whether it's constitutional. Well, the same thing. When I tell people I don't see a problem with this legally, that's not me saying I don't see a problem with it personally. But just because you don't like something, that doesn't render it unconstitutional. Wouldn't that be a great system if we, oh, well, I don't like it, that somehow makes it unconstitutional. So I'm not sure. If registries are constitutional, I'm not sure that there would be a constitutional provision that would exempt juveniles from being a part of a civil regulatory scheme. Although I find it totally distasteful and despicable that a state would register anybody in the way that they do, much less a person who committed the offense as a juvenile. But I don't know that that somehow makes it unconstitutional just because they're a juvenile.
There's the fourth paragraph. It says, Stevens is one of three men suing Alabama officials over what they say is the state's debilitating sex offender laws, which Alabama's probably pretty high up there, maybe the top five of shitty states that you could be on the registry in. But what I would then immediately ask is, it's equally debilitating for someone that's not convicted as a minor. Why would you draw that distinction? I don't think children are a protected class. So why would you draw the distinction there?
Well, there are a lot of states who've taken a much more rehabilitative attitude about what they do to juveniles. They won't do to an adult because the idea is the juvenile. And there's pretty bipartisan support for this notion that juveniles are special because of their age and their undeveloped minds. We frequently seal records, we shield juveniles, we try to protect juveniles. Now the states that are registering 12-year-olds there's some breakdown there, but like even Nebraska, they don't register juveniles that are adjudicated in juvenile court. Now those have out of state convictions, unfortunately, going to probably be registering as a result of the language of the state law, but juveniles derive a protection from what their states have given them. But I don't see that in the U.S. Constitution, which I think is your question. There's nothing in the Constitution that I can think of where juveniles are afforded any special protection. In fact, I think it'd be just the opposite. Kids are more or less considered property until they become adults, right?
Fair. I think that's right.
So I don't know that there's a constitutional claim. I'm dubious about how far this is going to go. I hope it's successful. I hope it's the beginning of cracking Alabama's horrible registry. There's been a challenge, the McGuire challenge, as far as I know, has been hanging out the 11th Circuit for several years now. And I don't know why it hasn't moved, what's had it stalled. But there's been challenges with very modest success. There was some ruling early this year that I think this article talks about. There was a federal judge ruled in some component of Alabama's registry was unconstitutional.
It also says in here that because of his continually stymied efforts to maintain a job, he resorted to selling dope to make ends meet. And then obviously he got caught for that and spent some time in prison. How do you navigate around? So I think Alabama has like a 2,500 foot restriction on things.
Oh, it's horrible. If you look at this article, they cannot live, volunteer, right, or work within 2,000 feet of a school or childcare facility. Their photos, names, and addresses are displayed on a website, which is common, and on flyers, which are distributed to neighbors. And, of course, they have to pay for that. Every 3 months, they must register in person and pay a $10 fee. Some of the registry also are prohibited from loitering within 500 feet of a school or childcare facility, which I don't know the nuances of that. More than 16,000 people are listed on that registry.
And then, like, anybody would wonder why they didn't have to resort to some sort of less than honest kind of work to feed themselves and make ends meet and pay bills and whatnot. Like, you force these people into what would be an underground economy just to make ends meet.
Absolutely. Well, the appeal article references the in February, which is what I was trying to think about. District judge said that the quote the most he considered Alabama was the most comprehensive and debilitating sex offender scheme in the nation. No other state system come close. He struck down the state's criminal sexual offender on the driver's license. And which they've reconstituted, and they're doing it in a coded way now. So they didn't give up. They just simply went back and took the sex offender off the driver's license because that was actually never put into statute. They just allowed the motor vehicle people to figure out how to do it, and they chose to do it that way.
That sounds very similar to the Halloween signs. If the DMV was just doing what they wanted to do.
Well, if the legislature doesn't tell them how to mark the licenses. Well, let's see. If it's a executive agency, let's see. The executive is elected, and if the executive appoints the person who heads that agency, do you think the executive is going to go out of their way to try to do it in the most kind and compassionate way without direction? Or do you think the executive who's subject to the will of the people is going to do what he or she thinks the will of the people is going to be more in favor of, which was the debilitating way they did it with putting sex offender on the license itself in big orange letters?
I can almost guarantee that they're going to do it in the most debilitating way, unless it's Larry Krasner that's the governor.
So, but yeah, this is a nice article. I did read it, and it's not as long as typically appeal articles are. So you can read this one a whole lot less time than one of their typical stories.
Let's cover some much better, much gooder news. The Collateral Consequences Resource Center has an article, and it says two southern states, which is shocking to me to begin with, states enact impressive occupational licensing reforms. We've covered in the past that when you do get any kind of conviction, you start ending up with prohibitions against all kinds of different licensing. You know, can you be a barber and so forth? And there's a whole bunch of states that are at least to some degree. So this is North Carolina and is it Virginia?
Mississippi.
Okay, Mississippi there at the top. They're reducing some of those barriers for people to get licensing and get into trade jobs.
And this is an example of your famous bipartisanship that you are so proud of.
Woo-hoo.
Sometimes it comes out well, and this is an example of like with the Gundy decision that we talked about,
right?
And the conservatives who made all their stand about the administrative state, they're simply wanting to dismantle the administrative state. Well, this is an example of the conservatives and the liberals coming together on something for different reasons. The conservatives don't care much for licenses to begin with. So like in Texas, they just let some of their plumber's license sunset. They didn't read the plumber's license and board's going to go out of business if there's not some change, because they're fundamentally against governmental licensing. Well, that's what's happening here. We've got the liberal do-gooders who think that there shouldn't be the prohibition against folks having a license, and you've got the conservatives who, well, I'm not much for all this darn government intervention anyway. So you can get a coalition to form on we had the same thing happen in my state. We had our former conservative governor saying, well, we need to revisit the issue of licenses. But this is just if you look at the list of states, Arizona conservative, Arkansas conservative, Florida conservative, Nevada maybe conservative, Ohio, Texas, Utah, West Virginia. These are all conservative states.
Right.
That are on this list that have enacted major licensing reform to make the debarment less available to those who are required to have a license. And I think that's a fantastic thing. And this is your bipartisanship at work.
Fantastic. Gotta love it when people come together and make decisions together.
For whatever their reasons are. Sometimes they have different reasons for the same result.
Alrighty then. Over at Fox59.com, what is this, like the Fox News Hour? Indiana lawmakers inch closer to making it illegal for sex offenders to advertise babysitting services. This is, unfortunately, this is a little bit of an old article. It's, from February, and then it was signed into law in May. But somehow it came up on our radar again. I don't remember where I picked this one up. But what did you want to highlight about this one?
What I wanted to highlight about it was that if you read the article, this was an emotional thing for this was feel good legislation. The bill was drafted after Madison County authorities realized a quote, a loophole prevented them from rearresting 26-year-old Anthony Carmack. Carmack had been on the Indiana registry since 2013 after being convicted of a child pornography and exploitation case. Now, generally, that is possession or possession and distribution of images. So somehow or another, that they find that that translates out into a hands-on offense. So it says that that the lawmaker was named Robin Hart, and she said that she was shocked when she learned of the gap in the law. So
what was the gap?
Well, the fact that he could actually, a person on the registry ought not be allowed to provide daycare services, because everybody knows if you're on the registry that you are a child molester.
Of course.
Yes.
Which is not true.
So, and I misspoke. Robin Hart was the owner of the Peanut Gang and in-home daycare.
Yeah.
So it was the lawmaker carried that at her request. So forgive me for the misreading it.
Senator Frank Mervin.
Yeah, that was actually the lawmaker. But it's just ridiculous. That this is a quote. Just ridiculous. Someone with a felon or a crime against children can work with children, she said. This is back to that to Robin. Now this is an example of what. Now I can assure you that the Indiana, whatever group they have there, had limited boots on the ground. But no one was at a committee saying, do you realize how ridiculous this is? There, you can be on the registry and never had touched a child. There's no evidence that just because you're on the registry that you pose a threat to children. So what you're saying is that no one who's been convicted of anything from indecent exposure to any other the litany of crimes, the Romeo and Juliet, these people can never supervise children responsibly. But this is one of those. This is some of your famous bipartisanship at work. This passed unanimously. Senate Bill 258 passed unanimously in committee. Now, I didn't go to the trouble to look up the votes, but I can just about guarantee you it was unanimous all the way through the process.
Which that's the comparison to like IML, where it went through all the things and then Obama signed it, and everyone's pissed off because Obama signed it, but it was never opposed along the way.
That is correct. I doubt that people showed up, and it would be tough to frame the arguments if you do show up. Because you're fighting a motion when a sex offender has the right to supervise children? Really, that's a no-brainer. Can you imagine what Book would say? What's his name in Florida?
Ron Book.
What Ron Book would say, because he's famous for quoting, these are no-brainers. He'd say, this is a no-brainer. They shouldn't be around kids. Really, is it a no-brainer? I'm not so sure it is such a no-brainer.
Because you can certainly be on the registry without committing some sort of even contact offense, let alone an offense against kids.
That is correct. But no one was there saying that to the legislature.
And also, do we have no expectation of rehabilitation, or are you forever going to hold on to that position that you can't be around kids because you're going to spontaneously molest them all?
That's where we are.
Awesome. Thanks, Fox 59, for that. And then our final article. Oh, this is my article. This is the one that I get to talk all technical.
All right. I can't wait.
This is from The Guardian, which is a European publication. Denmark frees 32 inmates over flaws in phone geolocation evidence. The way that this goes down is, so 32 people get released because of the evidence that was presented showing cell phone data of where they were, corroborated that they had committed these crimes. But, and what isn't exactly clear to me, do you remember the case, the Supreme Court case in the last, probably about a year, there were a bunch of guys that were convicted and they used cell phone tower data to prove that they were at these various Radio Shacks, probably like in 2010. And they use that evidence, but like the process of getting it, that's a third party. And can you get third party data? Did you consent to get this data released? All this stuff. And I'm pretty sure the Supreme Court upheld that the cell phone data was accurate. But where this is funky to me is they use some sort of analysis technique to figure out the cell phone tower data. And in some cases, the cell phone towers were reporting that people were 200 miles away from hey, you're 200 miles this way, but you're actually 200 miles in the other direction. And they just ultimately, it seems like they said that there's not enough validity in the data. It's not, what's the word I'm looking for? To say that it's solid enough to say that these people were where the cell phone data said that they were. This is bizarre.
I had a question, though. I was wondering, I wasn't able to are we saying that the human that interpreted the data
yes.
was not interpreting correctly, or are we saying that the technology that placed them there was wrong to start with? What are they saying?
So the part of, like, you know, your phone can only travel so far before, you know, to a tower. Like, obviously there's the curvature of the earth. Don't give me any flat earth stories either. But so there's a curvature of the earth and the radio signal can only go so far. You're not going to be able to run a cell phone signal 200 miles. You kind of would have to be within some proximity of where that tower is. How did they end up seeing that you're 200 miles away? I don't know, unless maybe like the tower didn't release you and it held on to you from being there. But yeah, to your question of did a human make a mistake, they were using some software to do the analysis. So a human wrote the software, but did the person running the software make the mistake, or did the computer program make this mistake? Wasn't clear to me in the article.
Well, that's what I was getting at, because like on fingerprint analysis, people are qualified as experts, and they'll tell you all the loop-de-loops and what they mean and how that this is a match. But the human can be wrong. And I was wondering if this cell phone data is subject to interpretation, or if we consider DNA to be very reliable. The courts do. And when I say we, the system considers DNA to be very reliable. But as we find out, all the things the humans handling of the DNA can cause it to not be so reliable as we had thought. So I was wondering if the humans had messed this up and the original raw data was correct, but the humans put the wrong spin on it.
So it says, among the errors police have discovered is a tendency for the system to omit some data during the conversion process, which means only selected calls are registered. And then there was some other stuff where it looks like maybe on the telephone company side, when messages were going out, like they recorded that they were in the wrong place. It just seems like there was enough inaccuracies. God, there's a word I'm looking for that I can't capture, but the inconsistencies in the data to say that you were actually at this place. If you send out a text message, that tower that you're nearest should be the one that picks it up. But if somehow a tower 200 miles away picks you up, I don't see, I guess it got flagged wrong. Obviously the tower 200 miles away didn't get flagged, but the message, their recording of it recorded the location wrong. So even I think at the source data, the information was inaccurate too.
So, well, it's amazing that we've got people that are serving long prison sentences on technology based. We're relying on technology, and it turns out that the technology is not as reliable as we had thought.
Yeah, I'm still struggling. I mean, the radio signal can only go so far. You're not pumping out 50,000 watts like, you know, we talk about AM radios. You're not pumping that out of your cell phone. You're only traveling miles at best on the frequencies and on the power out of your phone. It just can't go that far unless it bounced. I mean, it just doesn't even seem like plausible that it would make it that far. I'm sure I'm going to get excoriated by someone in chat about me talking about it that way.
Well, I know I will, because I don't know Jack, but we've got as we have evolved in our forensics, a lot of people are sitting in prisons on forensics.
Yeah, but even you mentioned the DNA thing. There's a statistical probability. I mean, obviously, it gets the probability goes down, but there's still a statistical probability that you and someone else have the same DNA.
Well, there is, but isn't it like many millions or maybe billions? It's pretty small, isn't it?
I think it's in the millions, but you still have so many billions of people on the planet. You could end up with, given all of the other evidence, it's, you know, we're eliminating a thing. We're not saying you did it, but we know it's not all of those other people. But then throw in, hey, we see you on the camera also at the same time. It's a piece of evidence that like eliminates things, but it's not an absolute. Plus, that stuff can be planted and fabricated.
Well, and I give an example. What fears me is that DNA is so easily transferable.
Correct.
That you could have been someplace that could connect you with a person who subsequently vanishes or something bad happens to, and your DNA being a part of their person doesn't
Correct.
Mean that you did anything bad. I give the hitchhiker story. You know, yep. What if I pick up a hitchhiker and give them a ride 30 miles up the road and my DNA's all over them, and then the person that kills them on the next hitchhike, they've never been arrested and they have no DNA. That doesn't mean I killed them, but they would put on, in a court of law, they would say, well, you know, clearly your DNA was on this person and you don't know them. Can you explain that?
Yeah. And we found hair in your car. So yeah, you definitely had them present with you. So how do we know you didn't do it?
Well, the evidence would be over. They turn up dead a half hour later after they yep. got out of my car. There's video showing the person exiting my car. There's DNA. They've got a dead corpse and I didn't kill them.
Correct. I'm with you. Back to having that high bar of beyond a shadow of a doubt, whatever, all those things, beyond a reasonable doubt. Well, I think to close out the show, we are going to have a conversation about originalism versus evolutionism from our good friend Antonin Scalia.
All right.
Let me finish. It is wrong to demand perfection of originalism. Well, we don't have the answer to everything, but by God, we have an answer to a lot of stuff. A lot of stuff, especially the most controversial. Whether the death penalty is unconstitutional. Whether there's a constitutional right to abortion, to suicide, and I could go on. All of the most controversial stuff. You go back and look, nobody thought that that's what the Equal Protection Clause meant, what the Eighth Amendment. Easy, easy answers. I don't even have to read the briefs, for Pete's sake. So, whereas, if you are an evolutionist, you don't have any answers. I mean, you don't have any answers. When we held that there was no constitutional right to assisted suicide, we said we are not yet prepared to announce a constitutional right. You know, stay tuned. In the fullness of time, another 20 years or whatever, you know, every day's a new day for the evolutionist. You know, last year, well, once the death penalty couldn't be imposed at 21, then it couldn't be imposed at 18, and everything changes. Panta rye. No, you're right. Originalism is not perfect, but boy, it is so much more perfect than evolutionism, where you're just looking up at the ceiling, and it's a new day. Every day's a new day. I wonder if the death penalty is unconstitutional yet.
There you go.
So I think by listening at Scalia as often as we have, we can, those who believe that they're strict constructionists, And you will be happy to know that a lot of things that you're for, that you believe the Constitution should provide for, just are not in his DNA. He does not believe that. And he's a very affable guy. He's funny as all get out.
I mean, bit of a smartass.
Yeah, he has the whole room cracking up at laughter, and he's charming and witty and all that stuff. But the outcomes that you think you're for, you would not get with Scalia, unless it's on strict construction, like on the Confrontation Clause. He actually was so strong on the Confrontation Clause, he helped us restore the right of confrontation in a ruling, which I can't cite the name of, but that had all but evolved its way out of the Constitution. And he helped us evolve it back into the Constitution, which he gets a lot of commendations from the defense bar because of his rigid support of the Confrontation Clause. He says it's absolute. It says that the person shall have the right to confrontation. So that particular thing alone, you could never have a stronger friend than you have with Scalia. But there's so much else that you would have very much find problematic, that if you relied on having nine Scalias, you'd be very unhappy with the outcome.
Definitely. I'm intrigued, you know, like in the first breath, he says that it's way better than the other philosophy. And no, of course, it doesn't have all the answers, but it answers so many things. I don't know. I do like that you bring these segments, and I'm intrigued to hear the legal philosophy behind them. I don't think that I agree with him on most of the points, though.
Well, I know I don't, but I want people to hear his words rather than my words, because our listeners tend to lean toward the conservative ideology, and they tend to lean toward that strict construction and that originalist view. And there are some slight advantages to that occasionally. And like I said, we're going to be using that strict construction, and we're going to be saying we're textualists magically on some of our litigation that we're planning in our state. But it's not the panacea that you think it is. And if you had nine justices like Scalia, you definitely would not like most of the rulings that would come out of the U.S. Supreme Court.
Outstanding. A perfect, perfect, perfect podcast recorded in the super secret underground bunker. And how can people find the podcast for us to grow our audience, Larry?
Well, they can go to registrymatters.co.
Outstanding. And of course, the phone number, which Will, I finally got Will, since he has something of some recording equipment, to not phone in a question. He sent it to me over Discord, but you could do the same and email it. But how could people phone in a question?
747-227-4477.
And then email?
If you have a question that can be succinctly answered or just want to contact us, it's registrymatterscast@gmail.com.
And then the best way to support the podcast, of course.
Well, that would be the best thing of all, to be patreon.com/registrymatters. That's patreon.
Awesome. Perfect. 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 Well, Larry, as we exit the super secret underground bunker, we can then again announce that we're going to be recording at the Georgia meetup next week on Saturday. And we're going to record before, I think, the meeting there at the library. If you guys want to come out and create all kinds of chaos and confusion to record a podcast.
Yes, that will be at the Clayton County Library, Riverdale branch on Valley Hill Road.
You're about to lose your voice.
In Riverdale. And we look forward to seeing hundreds and hundreds of people there.
Beautiful. Larry, thank you so much. And I will talk to you soon.
Good night.
Bye.